It's the 10th of July, Asalaha Puja, and tomorrow we'll be entering the Vasa period, the rains retreat period. So in Southeast Asia, it's the monsoon season. Here, it's the dry season. We still follow all of the rules and protocols and etiquette around entering a Vasa, and it's a normally considered to be a very special time. And so this is also quite a special day, Asalaha Puja. Preparing for the entering of the Vasa, the community is going to be more stable for the next 3 months. And anybody who leaves, we can only leave, any of the bhikkhus can only leave for a maximum of 6 nights, and then we have to return. So there's less, generally less coming and going during the Vasa period. And then it will end with the Pavarana day on the full moon of October, and then Katina after that. And this year is considered to be quite an early Vasa, and that's allowed us to do. So the 10th of July, I've seen it earlier than this a couple times, but this is about as early as it gets. And then that allows us to have a early Katina, which allows us to do the Abhayagiri India for Holy Sites pilgrimage starting November 1st. So there's a group already signed up for that. And that, so it's quite a special year. Feels like quite a special year. And we've had all these visits from our Krupa Ajahns. So Longpa Liam, Longpa Jandi were here in May. And then just much more recently, Longpa Khun, Longpa Damrong, senior disciples of Longpa Cha. And I felt that visit was quite special, quite impactful, quite meaningful. So I thought in connection with Asalaha Puja, which is a recollection of the Buddha's first teaching, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which we chanted this evening, and the Four Noble Truths, and also a recollection of Venerable Anya Kondanya, who was the first stream enterer, the first Savaka disciple, the first enlightened disciple of the Buddha. And so it's a recollection of Sangha as well, that the Sangha was born on this day until before the full moon of July, before the Buddha gave his first teaching. There was only Buddha and Dhamma, but then there's Sangha as well. So it is a recollection of Sangha on down to our great teachers, Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Liam, Ajahn Khun, Ajahn Damrong, all these, all the teachers who we have connections with, Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Pisano, Ajahn Amaro. So all of the teachers who have visited Abhayagiri and who support the community here and support us with their teachings and their metta, their goodwill. And so this is on down to the present. We still receive the benefits. We still receive the fruits of this through since the time of the Buddha, through history, and on down to the present. And some of the teachings that stuck out for me from our most recent visit, I've already shared previously some teachings that stuck out for me with Longpa Liam's visit, but I'd like to more reflect on the more recent visit of Longpa Khun and Longpa Damrong, because there was a few things that they said that they seemed to emphasize more than once. And one of them was, as some of you know, we took them to Fort Bragg to see the Three Jewels Branch Monastery. And we also took the opportunity when we were there to take them to Hendy Woods to see the very, very tall coastal redwoods. These are some of the tallest trees in the world. And they do have some big trees in Thailand, but there's nothing as tall as these coastal redwoods. It's always great to take people to see them, especially if they've never seen anything like it before. So with Longpa Khun and Longpa Damrong, it was their first time ever coming to America. And Longpa Khun, he made the point afterwards that, oh, he never thought anything like those redwoods existed. He'd never seen them before, so he didn't think they existed. But now that he saw them, then he knows they exist. And he said, it's just like the Dhamma. It's just like the Dhamma. Maybe we haven't seen it before, so we don't think it exists, and we don't know really what it is. But then when we see the Dhamma in our heart, then we will know that it exists, and we'll know that it's there, and we'll know what it's like. So he was, he emphasized that a couple of times, that just because we haven't seen the Dhamma doesn't mean it's not there, doesn't mean we can't get into contact with it. It is there. It's just we haven't seen it, so we don't know about it. We have to still continue to look for it. But once we see it, we'll know it's there. We'll know it exists, and there won't be any more doubts. And the other thing he was emphasizing was this sense of just being able to live in a way that is very ordinary and very normal. We don't need to do anything special as practitioners. It's just that, you know, if we just work all the time, if we don't ever rest, then the body, the mind gets very tense. So it's good to relax sometimes. And there's this phrase, pakpon bhavana, which is like relax and practice in a relaxed manner. And this Vasa period at Abhayagiri, we have 2-week solitary retreats that all of the monastic community members get to take part of, and we'll trade off doing those. And the first slot is Tanrakito, Tantisaro, and Anagarika Andrew Benin. So if you don't see them, they're on their 2-week retreat. And really, it gives that chance for practicing in a relaxed manner. And practice doesn't mean that we're trying to clamp down on the mind and become more tense than we already are. So practice is all about relaxing. It's all about learning how to relax. This took me a few years to figure out for myself. In reading the teachings of Lungpa Cha and reading some of the suttas, and I had this sense that it was all about forcing yourself into a state of peace and kind of beating yourself into submission, so to speak. And of course, that's a misreading. That's a misunderstanding of the suttas and of the teachings of the Kripa Ajahns. We reread teachings of somebody like Ajahn Mahabua and think, okay, he's saying kill the defilements, so I have to become very tense and angry and frustrated with myself. But that's certainly not the case. So we say pakpon bhavana, which is just practicing in a relaxed manner. Although, you know, not too relaxed, we have to find a sense of balance, find a just right, a sense of things being just right. But for us Westerners, I think we tend to need to relax. It's not about getting more tense. If we're really lethargic and not able to give rise to energy, yes, we need to pick things up a bit. But if there's a lot of tension and it's about relaxing, just sabai, just sabai, sabai. So Lumpa Kun talking about just, when you're hungry, you eat. When you're tired, you rest. When there's a time to do something in the monastery, you just do it. And then there's no sense of resistance. And there's a sense of contentment, well-being. And we just go about our duties, go about our day in a very normal fashion. It's incredibly ordinary. So this is the way of peace. At Portland Friends of the Dhamma, so we took them up to Portland and then up to Seattle. At Portland Friends of the Dhamma, there was a chance for some question and answer with Lungpa Kun and Lungpa Damrong. And one of our practitioners up there who's started practicing a bit later in life, he asked Lungpa Kun, he said, you know, what type of thing should I be practicing if I'm already older, already becoming elderly? And how should I practice? What kind of things should I learn? What kind of things should I study? And Lungpa Kun said, no, you need a shortcut. You know, I need to teach you about a shortcut. And don't do any study. You know, that's not going to help so much. Just kind of set everything down. Just lay everything down. Just let go of everything you can as quickly as possible. And he said, it's like this teaching of Lungpa Cha where, you know, you're carrying something heavy. You're carrying a heavy burden, carrying a heavy rock on your shoulder. And you go around asking everybody, why is it heavy? And this rock is really heavy. Why is it so heavy? And go around asking people, and they tell you, well, that's a rock. It's very heavy. Rocks are heavy. That's their nature. And you go, oh, it's so heavy. I'm getting really tired carrying this rock around. And he said, what makes it heavy? Is it the elements? Is it what makes it heavy? And then he says, well, then you figure it out. Then you set it down and it's not heavy anymore. So what makes it heavy is that you picked it up. If you don't pick it up, it's not heavy. So that's, he said, that's the shortcut. If you want to get peaceful quicker, just set everything down. You don't have to do a lot of study. There's not a lot of things to memorize. Just lay it all down. And if we aren't able to lay it all down, then it's going to continue to be heavy. It's going to continue to be heavy and continue to be a burden until we're able to lay it down. That's just true for all of us, whatever age we are, whoever we are. So that's a reflection on just whenever we experience dukkha or whenever we experience suffering in our lives, it's because we're carrying something heavy. And these five khandhas are heavy by their very nature, just having a body that gets sick and grows older and has to pass away eventually. Just taking ownership of that, and if we're not able to see the anatta nature of the body, that it's not me, not mine, it's just a temporary, we call this the vihara dhamma, it's a temporary dwelling. We've got one day's shelter, one life's shelter, and then the deathless shelter. These are the vihara dhammas. You've got one day's shelter is your dwelling place, whether you're staying in a kuti, monk's hut in the forest here, or whether you're staying in a house, or whether you're staying in a hotel room. This is one night's shelter. Then you have one life's shelter. So that's your body. Your body is the one life's shelter. Your body is this, is like a house. It's a house for the vinyan. It's a house for the chitta, for one life. And then at the time of death, that shelter is relinquished and another shelter will be sought. But then there's Buddha Dhamma Sangha, which is the deathless shelter. So like everybody chanted with the taking of the, not just the precepts, but you take the refuges and the precepts. And the refuges are the, what we call the permanent shelter, the deathless, the eternal shelter. The place which is always reliable, the place which is always safe, the place which is always cool and at ease, place which will never deceive us, the place which will never let us down. So that's Buddha Dhamma Sangha. So what we recollect on Asalaha Puja is after the Buddha's awakening, he thought, who should he teach? And he had these five ascetics who were practicing with him during his horrific austerities that he was undertaking. This is what we call the Dukkhagirya, the severest of austerities that the Bodhisatta, wasn't yet the Buddha, Bodhisatta was undertaking, and he had five companions who were also practicing austerities with him. And eventually when the Bodhisatta saw for himself that he brought his body and his mind to the ultimate point of suffering, that actually wasn't right, that wasn't the path. So that bringing it to the ultimate point of tension and right to the edge of death, where the body is just completely dried up and pushing away any sense of even mental happiness and rejecting is a radical rejection of everything. And that's what we call the Dukkhagirya for all of you people who like polyterms. And so noticing that, okay, that's not the path. That's not the path. And then relinquishing that. And his five ascetic companions were dissatisfied with him, and that he started to take food again and nursed himself back to health. And so his companions were dissatisfied and they left. But they also had very strong, very powerful spiritual qualities. They were also able to do these incredible austerities. So they did have highly developed spiritual qualities of endurance and extremely incredible resolve. But they left, and then the Bodhisatta was left alone to practice unburdened by those five companions. And as the story goes, after he nursed himself back to health, and then he was offered the milk rice by the maiden Sujata, and then went to the Bodhi tree and attained awakening through the three watches of the night on the full moon of May on Visakha Puja. And as time went on, he's absorbed in the bliss of release, the bliss of liberation. He eventually recollects, you know, can anybody understand this? Who should I teach? And he realizes that his five companions have the spiritual qualities developed enough that they could understand the Dhamma. So he starts to make his way to the deer park at Benares, which is on foot. Takes a couple months, takes a mother deer. He wanders in stages in a way of pakpon bhavana. He doesn't need to strive anymore. He's the Buddha. He's finished his practice. So he's going in a relaxed manner. He's not in a hurry. And he makes his way to this park of the seers, the deer park at Isipatana, which is where those five companions were to be found. And then teaches them the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Before that, though, they see him coming in the distance, and they say, oh, that's the ascetic Gotama who reverted to luxury. He gave up his austerities and reverted to luxury. But then they notice his radiance and this incredible feeling of metta coming off of him, and they can't help themselves. They set out a mat for him, a place to sit. They start serving him automatically, even though they agreed with each other that they wouldn't, that they would ignore him. They say, when he comes, we will just ignore him and not serve him and not rise up to greet him. And they weren't able to keep their pact with each other. They were so inspired by just the sheer power of his presence that they had to get up, and they served him in every way possible. And then they listen to the Dhamma, and the teaching of the Four Noble Truths is this very practical and basic teaching. It's nothing extraordinary. And yet this is what's peculiar to Buddhas. The Buddhist religion is the only religion in the world that teaches the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path. And it's just something so ordinary. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. It's virtue, meditation, wisdom, discernment. But it's just the first part of it is there is suffering. There is suffering. And it doesn't say there is your suffering or there is my suffering. It just says there is suffering. Idang dukang just means there is suffering. It's totally impersonal. So there is suffering everywhere. It's all over. It's all over. We can look anywhere and we'll see it. We'll see it in whether it's in each other or the dissatisfaction that we might experience with our friends or people who aren't our friends, our enemies, our people who we find threatening. We can even see it in the forest animals, the way they suffer, having to constantly seek food and run away and try to not get eaten by other forest animals. And anywhere we look, there is suffering. So there is suffering. And then the Buddha says, well, you might not understand if I say there is suffering. So what is suffering? Well, birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Not getting what one wants is suffering. Not acquiring what one wants is suffering. Coming into contact with what one doesn't want is suffering. In brief, the five khandhas are suffering. So the Buddha just goes on to just explain in a very normal way, this is just what life is, and we have to experience pain and different types of mental torment at different times, and it's just normal. It's just the way it is. It's not even a judgment. It's not saying, oh, no, you're suffering so much. It's totally ordinary, and everybody has this. But then he goes on to say that there is a cause of suffering, that it's actually something that doesn't have to happen. So the cause of suffering is craving. And this is incredibly profound, actually, because it's too easy. It's too close. It's too basic. It's too primary. That's why we keep missing it. So this tanha, the craving, three types of craving, kama tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. So kama tanha is the most common one. Craving for any type of sensuality. That's the craving for beautiful sights, sounds, nice smells, good tastes, good tactile sensations with the body, pleasure of all types. And the sixth sense base is the mind. So craving for wonderful, good ideas and beautiful mental states. So this is sense desire. So the craving for sense pleasures, the craving for sensuality. Then there's the craving for becoming. That's bhava tanha. And then there's the craving to be annihilated, or the craving to not exist anymore, vibhava tanha, that those three types of craving are what create what we call samsara, or the round of pain, the round of rebirth. So we keep cycling through these different types of craving, and then that causes endless dukkha. So we have, say, craving to become, we have bhava tanha, and we might think, oh, I'm just going to be done with everything. But then that's vibhava tanha. So we keep cycling between these different types of craving. And that the incredible balance that goes beyond those three types of craving is what we call the majjhima patipada, or the middle way of practice. That's the Noble Eightfold Path. So these, we could also say there's, in the Thai way of seeing things, there's this three realms of existence, well, in the suttas, but also it's lifted up more in the Thai tradition than perhaps in the West, that the kama loka, the desire realm, the rupa loka, the realm of form, and arupa loka, which is the formless realms. These three realms make up all of samsara, all of the cyclic existence. And those do, we can link those with kama tanha, bhava tanha, and vibhava tanha, that they cause those three realms of existence to come into being. And hearing this can be tough. It can be hard to hear this. You know, just thinking, oh, craving is the cause of suffering, because how many times do we think our suffering is caused by something other than craving? So what the Buddha is saying is coming, it's something we're doing. It's coming from inside of us. It's some way we're responding. It's some way we're relating to the world. So craving is the cause of suffering. Tanha is the samudaya, the cause of suffering. How often is it? No, it's the weather that's the cause of my suffering. It's the political system that's the cause of my suffering. It's something outside that's the cause of my suffering. It's the friend who I had to block on Facebook that's the cause of my suffering. It's whatever, anything on the outside, which is the cause of my suffering. The Buddha's saying, no, it's craving. It's craving that's the cause of the suffering. It's wanting things to be otherwise, wanting things to be other than what they are. It's the cause of the dissatisfaction, the cause of the suffering. Cut that off, and there's no more problems. There's no more issues. There's no more worries. There's only coolness, ease, peace, and well-being and contentment. And it's like Longpo Cha said in one of his teachings, like, we spend so much time fighting. We spend so much time fighting and pushing and striving. Why not try it out in a different way? Why not step off of the battlefield of life? Come over here where it's cool in the shade. Why not give it a try? Do you dare? Do you dare live where it's cool? Do you dare get off the battlefield and stop fighting? That was one of the teachings I read in a book called Still Forest Pool that made me want to ordain, actually. Reading that teaching, I thought, yes, that's it. That's it, Longpo Cha. So the third noble truth is that there is a cessation of dukkha, that it is possible. It is possible for dukkha to end. It is possible for suffering to come to an end. How do you do it? How do we do it? It's not easy. If it was easy, there would be a lot more people who weren't suffering. It's difficult. It's difficult. It takes the development of what we call parami, these spiritual qualities, patient endurance, kanti parami, oton, we say in Thai, oton. So we say kanti parami. This is having to, human beings can adapt to almost anything, almost any circumstance. And so if we develop these mental factors of patient endurance, we say the patient person is always happy. So we can adapt to any circumstance. Patient endurance, generosity, learning to relinquish, learning to give up, not taking things for ourselves, learning how to be givers, giving with an open hand, not with a closed fist. Lumpur Damrong, one of the teachings he was giving that I misunderstood, had to be clarified later for me. Pretty difficult for me to translate him. Similar to Lumpur Liam speaking in idioms and in a very poetic way. He's saying on one talk that Don Gert meet that gum. So I originally translated that as when we're born, we only have our kama, but that was a wrong translation. The meaning is, don't meet that gum. Gum is a fist. When you're born, a baby has their hand in a fist. All babies, if you look at a baby when they're born, their hand is never open. Their hand is always in a fist. It's the same for all newborn babies. They come out and their hand is in a fist. And that shows the suffering and also that they're ready to grasp everything in the world. So, and then Wela Dai meet that Klai. So it's like at the time of death, the hand opens. The hand is open when someone dies. So when someone is born, the hand is in a fist. And when someone dies, the hand is open. So when we're born, we're ready to grasp everything. The closest thing we can, we're going to grasp it. And then at the time of death, we have to let go of everything. So we need to train to be able to do that. We need to train to be able to do that beforehand. We want to really, truly be able to open the hand and just let go of everything. So in between that period, between our birth and our eventual death, how can we train ourselves? How can we get ourselves prepared to let go of everything? And this is what Ajahn Chah would say, die before you die. The path of meditation, the path of practice, it's really like a death process. As we practice, all the memories from our life, it's going to come up. As we do hours of walking meditation, hours of sitting meditation, all these memories are going to come up and we're going to think, oh yeah, I don't want to look at all this. Maybe there's some good memories we do want to look at, but I don't want to have to deal with all this. But this is the path of meditation. It's very much like a death process. And it's like cleaning it out. So die before you die, and the mind can be at peace. So this is the Nirodha. This is the cessation of suffering that is possible. It's something that struck me of Lumpur Khun also, and Lumpur Damrong. They both did this. They said several times that talking about the Four Noble Truths and Buddha Dhamma Sangha, say the Buddha, the Awakened One, the Knower, and so on, really is a reality. It really does exist. A Dhamma really is a reality. It really does exist. The Four Noble Truths and the cessation of suffering, it really is a reality. It really does exist. It's not just hearsay. It's not just a rumor. It's not just some interesting philosophical system that was invented by monks. It really does exist. The ending of suffering really does exist. It really is as the Buddha said it is in the suttas. It really is as Ajahn Chah said it is. It really is that way. It really does happen that way. So the path, we want to be on the path. The beginning of it is the precepts, which many of you determined this evening. And of course, those of us living in the monastery, we're devoting our lives to the keeping of precepts and the keeping of virtue, ethical conduct. Just think how amazing that is, that the fourth precept, for example, just not lying, how rare that is in the world. Lying is so normal. You know, everybody lies. Yeah, it's normal. It's something that isn't really seen as not always seen as a non-virtue. Just maybe it's necessary. You're supposed to lie on the, you know, job interview. It's everybody does it. It's expected. There was a former Anagarika here who went to work for Amazon, I guess. And the interviewer actually told him he was supposed to lie on the interview. The interviewer actually told him, like, no, everybody does this. Like, you just have to write in this and this and this in the box and I'll give you the job. And he couldn't do it. He's like, what's wrong with you? Like, I'm telling you, like, I'm the interviewer. I'm going to hire you. I'm telling you to lie on it. It's so weird. So he couldn't get the job. He is keeping the five precepts, so he couldn't get the job. But that's the path. You know, we'll look for a job where they're going to value honesty. That's where you need to work. So the Four Noble Truths, Anya Kondanya, he was just known as Kondanya before, and then for people who like to geek out on the life of the Buddha a little bit, Kondanya was actually, if you go back to the birth of the Bodhisattva, there was all these seers who came, and they were said to make predictions about the baby Buddha-to-be, and with King Suddhodana, his father there, and these seers come in, and there's a line of them. They put up two fingers, which means, you know, if he stays with the household life, then he is going to be a universal ruler, a wheel-turning monarch, what we call the Chakawatin. If he leaves the home life, he will become a fully enlightened Buddha and pulling back the veil of the world. So they put up two fingers. But then there was one seer, the last seer, he came and he just put up one finger, which meant he's definitely going to be a Buddha and there's no other path for him. And that was Kondanya. So that was, he was actually older already when the Buddha actually came of age and attained awakening. And so he puts up one finger and he's also the first Sotapanna. So the one was also for him. So he's the first Sotapanna. He understands the Four Noble Truths, and the Buddha says, he got it. He got it. He understands. Somebody understands this. And the Dhamma, he opens the Dhamma eye. So then he becomes known as Anya Kondanya. So the one who knows, Kondanya who knows. So he's the first Savaka disciple, the first Bhikkhu disciple. And the Buddha goes on, of course, to teach the Anattalakkhana Sutta. He goes to teach them by stages over the course of the Vasa period. Hence the Vasa period, the Rains Retreat period, becoming a very special time. They all spend the Vasa together. And they don't always go alms around. Usually the Buddha was constantly instructing them in the Dhamma. And two or three of them would go and get alms food and then share it out. And they would trade going alms around. So none of them was going alms around every single day. So they would share out the food. And the Buddha's constantly teaching them and then culminating with the Anattalakkhana Sutta, which they all become arhants at that point. So this full moon day of July is a recollection of that time. It's Buddha Nusati, but it's also Dhamma Nusati and Sangha Nusati. It's recollection of Buddha, recollection of Dhamma, recollection of the qualities of the Sangha, recollection of the possibility of awakening, recollection of the Four Noble Truths, which we're just trying to use as a practical tool to guide our daily lives, our daily life practice. So this is something we really can make use of over time, and it will be to our great benefit if we do make use of it, if we do make much of it. So I think that's enough for the time given for this evening, for an evening reflection. I'll leave it at that.